I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we present the third in a series of community panels called We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? Co-presented by the Women's March of San Francisco. Today's panel features representatives from various environmental organizations to discuss the challenges they face during the new administration, including Samantha Couch from NextGen Climate, Lisa Hoyos from Climate Parents, Sheridan Inomoto from Green Action, and Amy Aguilera from Poder. The moderator is legislative aide to San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell, Kanishka Karunaratna, who will introduce our panelists.
Hello. Thank you all for being out here tonight. Thank you to the JCC and the Women's March for putting together another panel. So I want to just jump right in and go ahead and introduce our panelists. So first we have Lisa Hoyos from Climate Parents. She is the director. She has experience as a campaigner in the labor and environmental movement for over 20 years. Experience in the Blue-Green Alliance, which is a clean energy jobs advocacy organization, AFL-CIO, and Greenpeace. She's been a staffer to the California Senate Natural Resources Committee, and she co-founded Climate Parents in 2012 out of concern for how climate change is already impacting our families and our health and safety, and with the belief that parents and grandparents and families are motivated now to mobilize for clean energy solutions. And then we have Samantha Couch here from NextGen Climate. She is the Strategic Innovations Manager for NextGen Climate Change. She handles a variety of projects. Most recently, she's focused on grassroots mobilizations and special events for NextGen's president, Tom Steyer. And she has years of experience working on a variety of climate change, immigration, and education issues. And then to my right here, we have Amy Aguilera. She is a civic engagement organizer with Poder. She became involved with social justice work after learning about H.R. 4437. That was a discriminatory legislative bill aimed at California's immigrant communities. She's born and raised in Oxnard to immigrant parents, and she saw that this kind of injustice would harm many families like her own, which led her to volunteer and then work in social justice groups. Her focus at Poder is on community education around immigrant rights and advocacy on language justice for monolingual Spanish speakers. And then we have Sheridan from Green Action, Sheridan Onomoto. She is a climate and environmental justice community organizer and policy advocate at Green Action for health and environmental justice. She cares deeply about watershed restoration and is knowledgeable on traditional ecological methods. And she has a lot of experience in indigenous activism. So we have a panelist of these organizations that sort of work in environmental justice and environmentalism at the local, regional, and national level. But before we get into the kind of work they do, I wanted to set up sort of a broadly accepted understanding of what environmental justice is. I think we all hear this term, and it'd be good to get sort of an accepted definition. And since Green Action, I think very boldly states that they do specifically environmental justice work. If Sheridan, if you could start with sort of sharing your understanding of what environmental justice is.
Sure. Aloha mai kakou, everyone. Grateful to be here. Thank you. So I think we hear environmental justice around, but a lot of people don't know what that means. So I'm actually going to read from... There are 17 principles of environmental justice. This was created at a... Leadership Summit in 1991, and I'm just going to read what came from just the first part of this sort of principles of environmental justice. I'm going to read the first part of this statement. We, the people of color, gathered together at this multinational people of color environmental leadership summit to begin to build a national and international movement of all peoples of color to fight the destruction and taking of our lands and communities. Do hereby reestablish our spiritual interdependence to the sacredness of our Mother Earth, to respect and celebrate each of our cultures, languages, and beliefs about the natural world and our roles in healing ourselves, to ensure environmental justice, to promote economic alternatives which would contribute to the development of environmentally safe livelihoods, and to secure our political, economic, and cultural liberation that has been denied for over 500 years of colonization and oppression, resulting in the poisoning of our communities and land and the genocide of our peoples, do affirm and adopt these principles of environmental justice. But more importantly, I think, especially for Green Action, which is for health and environmental justice, what we really promote is considering all communities and being all inclusive and ensuring really just the protection of the environment, but also promoting health for everyone. I think that's an easier summary, but I think it's important to understand the history of where environmental justice, where the language started to come from and how it got started back in the 90s.
That's right. It's sort of a fairly new a new focus within the field of environmentalism. And so I think, Lisa or Samantha, if you guys have anything else to add to your accepted definition of what environmental justice is, or any examples of issues that have become environmental justice issues.
Well, I know for me, when I started working on climate and in the environment, you think of really big picture problems. We think of global warming, we think of seawater levels rising, and really when you start drilling down into it, there are things that are affecting our communities every day. There are asthma rates that are rising, there are areas in California, especially where I come from in the Central Valley, that are kind of wastelands to a lot of these toxic things that are happening. And of course, these are communities of color. These are people who are not able to advocate for themselves. And so when I think of environmental justice and kind of the approach that I take to this work in general is advocating for all of those people, because they deserve, you know, clean air and safe drinking water.
Great.
And then I would just add, so I was at that 1991, it was called the First National People of Color Environmental Justice Leadership Summit. It was in DC. And it was a lot of community-based organizations, civil rights organizations, kind of calling out the mainstream environmental movement for saying, you know, the environment's not something out there. Like the shorthand way to describe it was the environment is where we all live, work, and play. So if someone lives in downtown Detroit and they live by a polluting facility or a refinery or a freeway, that's the environment. And how do we work to ensure that we create systems that keep our air clean? Now, obviously, fast forward a few decades, I work and my organization works, and Climate Parents is part of the National Sierra Club. I started it a few years ago as a small nonprofit, but now it's part of the National Sierra Club. And now it's fair to say that the social justice movements of the 90s and the 2000s have really shifted dramatically how a lot of the, you know, typically mainstream organizations operate on many, many levels around justice, equity, and inclusion. And well, I'll stop there, but we'll talk. It'll be woven throughout the evening, I'm sure.
And so, Amy, do you have any examples of environmental justice issues that Poder has been focused on?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, for us at Poder, environmental justice is the right to live in a clean and healthy environment, right? But a lot of the problems is that these clean and healthy environments are not accessible to our communities. It's specifically in low-income, disadvantaged communities that we get a lot of these, you know, polluting facilities. We're, you know, dumping grounds for other parts of the city. And at Poder, you know, we just recently, actually, you know, we fight a lot for green space, green zones, right? And last week, 2 weeks ago, we celebrated the opening of a brand new park, the first park in San Francisco in over 10 years, called Inchan Cajal, which was named in collaboration with the Mayan community that partake in Poder's membership. And so we were able to take this lot that no one was using, and we turned it into this beautiful park that now our families can come, as Lisa said, come live, work, and play around the area. And on the other side, there's going to be an affordable housing unit attached to it. So we're creating, you know, and taking these vacant lots and zones and turning them into green spaces that our families and community can enjoy. So that's like one of the examples.
And I think on a national scale, when we hear about environmental justice issues, it's things that are much more alarming. Like we hear about factories dumping their waste in lower income communities without really any recourse because there isn't anybody advocating for them or to assist them in enforcing laws. And so that's a question I have for all of you. Do you think that injustices like that are happening because our existing laws are not strong enough, or are they not being enforced adequately?
Well, I know a lot of people are here, or if I understand this speaking, sort of this series of panels correctly, it emerged, at least in part, out of people's sense of doom after Trump was elected, and as a resurgence, a part of the resurgence that was evidenced in the Women's March and so on. And so, I mean, right now there's a full-scale assault on, as we all know, on the EPA. There was a great event that Susie Tompkins-Buell organized a couple months ago here in San Francisco, and Gina McCarthy, the former EPA administrator, spoke at it. And it was fascinating to hear her speak because she was the right hand of Obama in implementing the Clean Power Plan, which would have, if it could have come into effect, would have reduced power plant pollution in this country by 30%. And would have really paved the way for the expansion of clean energy, even in states that aren't like California. In California, we have a strong movement to grow and expand clean energy. We have strong leadership. Places like Alabama, places like Georgia, not so much. And so the Clean Power Plan would have been amazing in terms of helping that transition. But that's not happening. And the message that Gina McCarthy had that was inspiring, I think, to just all those sort of regular activists like me and listening to her, was change really happens from the bottom up. It happens because we insist on it. It happens because we show up to hearings. It happens because we show up to congressional town halls. It happens because we join groups like Indivisible or Swing Left or other groups and new social movement formations that are where if you're from California, you can still make a difference in another state. And so I was inspired by that message. But working for the Sierra Club, where we have a tough legal team, a very crack, smart legal team, they have their work cut out for them. Because everything from our clean water regulations to our coal ash regulations to the Clean Power Plan to just the governance of EPA and having the top levels of government in, if you look up in the sky, and I'll end on this, at the flags that are on the most carbon pollution in the atmosphere, it's still the U.S. Even if we're the second biggest emitter, we're the largest historic emitter. And so to have the U.S. government's leader, President, you know, Trump, say that climate change is, you know, take the fifth on whether climate change, you know, is real, or to say, as he did, that it's a, what would you say, a plot by the Chinese
hoax.
Yeah, a hoax. You know, it's problematic. And so the voices of people like us have never been more important.
Yeah, I think the reaction to Trump, I think something that we've learned from this administration is that the laws that we thought were in place, it's really as strong as the person that's there to enforce it. And I think it was Senator Booker that highlighted this in his objection to Jeff Sessions' appointment, which was his concern that Jeff Sessions would not stand up for underprivileged communities and the way that they were being treated in terms of environmental justice and factory waste that was happening in those communities. So is there anything that we can do to advocate and keep the pressure on our elected officials to ensure that they hold these corporations accountable?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in today's world, there are so many things that we can do just from our own homes and with the internet and calling your elected officials. NextGen runs a program where we have volunteers send text messages to urge people to take action depending on what craziness is coming out of DC. So I think, you know, for a long time, volunteering kind of seemed like a burden to people, or like they couldn't really make a difference. But I think, you know, you can certainly volunteer in a local area, but when we have all of these new resources and tools, your voice can really be heard exponentially across and certainly in DC. And I know a lot of people who are working and say that this pressure does make a difference. And if you blow up someone's office in DC with, you know, 30 organized calls, 50 organized calls, you will make a statement. And I think that we need to, you know, make sure people understand that their voices will be heard. I think we saw a lot during the election that people felt like maybe their vote didn't count, or, you know, my vote doesn't matter. But I think that this is a real tangible way that you can see that your voice does matter. And so that's what I would kind of urge people to continue to do.
Great. I've also heard that organized blocks of calls at a certain time, because it sort of really rings the alarm for them, like, oh my gosh, we're getting blown up right now. So organizations like NextGen, and there's a lot of this activity on Twitter, have calls to action within this window of time to like start making calls. So it's one way that we can all get engaged directly on these issues.
Oh yeah, I just wanted to add that definitely it's really important to hold our elected officials accountable, and especially jamming their doors and getting into their offices is really important. Poder participates with the California Environmental Justice Alliance, CEJA, and its 9 partner organizations, and we push for environmental policy every single year. And so it's also been a way to work with our community members and let them know that Sacramento belongs to us. You know, we are taxpayers and we need to hold our electeds accountable. And so last year, it was really exciting because a lot of environmental racism and environmental justice comes because of race-based housing and zoning policies. It impacts all of our lives. We all live in the same city, but depending on your zip code or what part of the city you live in, you're going to have a different health impact. And so we were able to pass last year with CEJA, really, really doing a lot of advocacy, SB 1000, which was authored by Senator Connie Leyva. And pretty much is what it does is that it makes sure that we incorporate an environmental justice lens into statewide land use policy. So every general plan, city or county, has to have an environmental justice lens. It has to be considered. And this is such a great thing because we really need to put into practice community planning, right? People need to be a part of shaping their communities and what their communities look like. So this is going to be such a powerful piece of legislation once, you know, we really start to use it. So yeah, I just wanted to share advocacy on that statewide level.
Thank you. Yeah, I also wanted to speak more on the local level right here in the Bay, speaking to that. Last week, Green Action and a few other organizations have been invited to participate in a series of workshops with the Bay Conservation and Development Commission around, so BCDC, this commission is made up of commissioners from a variety of counties across the Bay Area that talk about the Bay and the waterfront. They have some regulatory permits around the waterfront, but they have been really smart, I think, in inviting community organizations in workshopping to figure out what we're going to do when the sea level, because the sea level is rising, apparently. It continues to rise. And there's studies showing that the sea levels will be rising several feet by the year 2100. But we need to be in the conversation now. There has been a BCDC working group with environmental justice organizations and having a conversation and inviting them and thinking about environmental justice and social equity in the Bay Area plan. So what does that really mean? When you include an amendment on environmental justice and social equity in a plan, this is how I presented it when I spoke on Thursday at a public hearing. So by the way, there's many ways to be involved. There are public hearings and ways to be invited to different decision planning making around the Bay. And I highly encourage you to look into that. There was a public hearing on Thursday about this inclusion, and I asked the commissioners, basically, we need to start thinking like water. Water is all-inclusive, and it does not discriminate. When it moves, it moves. It doesn't think about whether or not you're a new resident moving into Bayview's Hunters Point, which is a federal Superfund site, or it doesn't think about someone living in public housing in Rodeo next to an oil refinery. But we need to start thinking like water. We are the ones who tend to be, as we've learned from history, like places like Katrina, what happened with Katrina. We're not always inclusive. We don't always think about all these communities, and we do tend to forget and discriminate. But we need to start thinking differently, because water doesn't have time, but we need to be on time.
You're listening to We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? A community panel on environmental rights, featuring Samantha Couch from NextGen Climate, Lisa Hoyos from Climate Parents, Sheridan Inomoto from Green Action, and Amy Aguilera from Poder. They're joined in conversation by Kanishka Karunaratna on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So we need to rethink the way we think about our environment. Like, where does our water come from? Do we know where our water comes from? Have you visited where your water source is? Do you know about it? Things like that. There's a variety of ways to be involved, but definitely, like, something as small as your local, like, Bay Area Commission around the waterfront to a public hearing, or even thinking about where your water's coming from your faucet, really important. It starts within your own house. There's a saying, what we take out into the world is what we bring from our house. So I actually encourage people to even start on that small scale and work out. And you'll be surprised what kind of things you'll discover and what we need voices to speak out for. So I think what I'm really learning, though, in my involvement, even on the local level, is people aren't really thinking. It's amazing. There's a lot of agencies, there's a lot of different groups for the environment, but they do not talk about environmental justice. They do not think about social equity, and we're having to do that more and more. And I'm grateful that we do have work, you know, we are, you know, all sitting here doing this work and advocating, but I think we need definitely more voices and more involvement on that front.
Yeah, backstage we were talking about how nice it is to have a panel specifically focused on environmental justice rather than environmentalism overall, because I think we all, especially in San Francisco, we recycle and we compost and we try to drive cleaner cars and have cleaner energy sources, but do we think about the other communities in San Francisco that are also being affected and maybe disproportionately? So with sea level rise, if you look at a map of San Francisco, sea level rise will first affect the Bayview and the Shipyard area and also the Marina. Those will be the two most heavily inundated parts of San Francisco. And it's important to think about when we forward plan for how we support those communities, are they going to be supported equally? Are they going to be treated equally? Is the city going to fund development in those communities forward thinking equally, and we as citizens can advocate for that and make sure our policymakers know that it's important that the entire shoreline is protected equally.
And what I forgot to mention is at that hearing, the commission voted and it was passed. So they are including environmental justice and social equity in the Bay Area plan for adapting to sea level rise.
Great. And so if you want to get involved in these issues, I think coming to public comment on, especially BCDC doesn't have a lot of public engagement. And so if you come out as a member of the public to a body like that, your voice will be heard. And the best way to stay informed of that is to either follow that or BCDC's website, and you can sign up for emails there, or any of these organizations. I mean, what these advocacy groups do is rely on a mailing list to get people connected to issues that you're advocating for to help you plug in directly with your electeds and other policymaking bodies. So we've sort of heard from local and regional on what you guys are doing. I'd like to hear, Samantha, from NextGen. So at NextGen, I feel like we all became more aware of it in the last election when we started seeing ads with Tom Steyer, who's a very public figure for the organization. But it's he has really focused on forcing a public conversation on climate change, and it's been refreshing to see it as, like, this is accepted, it's happening, what can we be doing?
Yeah, yeah, and that was a really intentional thing, right? When we're talking about how we talk about climate and clean energy in a public way, there's not a conversation on is it real. It is. We've accepted it, and now let's start to think of solutions. And I think, you know, from the perspective of NextGen, we are talking about climate and clean energy in the perspective of an electoral setting. And so we want people, voters like you, to really think about the environment and climate when you're making your political calculus at the ballot box. So whether that's your local electeds, whether that's, you know, someone running for Senate, whether that's the president, we think that injecting an issue into really what you're going to fight for and vote for is important. And that's what one of our largest programs last year was, a campus program where we were on almost 400 campuses across battleground states targeting young voters. And one of the main things that we learned from that program was we lead with issues, and then they can make their decisions on the candidate that they choose. Obviously, last year was a really unique scenario in terms of the presidential election. And so when we said, okay, this is where candidates, you know, up and down the ticket fall on climate and clean energy, you know, it's up to you to make your decision on what you value, then we saw a lot of results that way.
And it's encouraging because younger voters do believe in climate change, and it's an important issue for them. They see their future in it. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think we saw in 2016, and we're going to continue to see, but the millennials and the younger voters are the largest block now, surpassing the baby boomers in terms of size. And I think that you're really seeing a lot of them engage on climate and clean energy and look to the future.
So Lisa, I know that Climate Parents also does a lot of national level work. So can you talk a little more about what's on the priority list for you guys in the coming year and how we can get engaged to support those efforts?
Sure. So Climate Parents is working with a major Sierra Club campaign called Ready for 100, Ready for 100% Clean Energy. And the goal there is, in the abdication of federal leadership, it's really incumbent upon and a great opportunity for localities to step up and commit to 100% clean energy. So we're part of this bigger campaign. And so there's just two things to name that are super exciting. One is that we launched a campaign with the Ready for 100 campaign called Mayors. Well, they launched it. Climate Parents engaged in it and moved families and parents and such to get involved. But we got mayors to commit to 100% clean energy, to publicly commit to 100% clean energy in the run-up to the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting, which happened at the end of June in Miami. And over 100, like, our goal at first was 50, because we launched in April, so we had like a three-month runway. And 150 mayors from all around the country, including red states, committed to 100% clean energy. And what that does is it creates kind of point of entry for us to then seek resolution. So right now, since this campaign began a year ago, 35 cities, including Georgetown, Texas, is like red as all red can be, to Columbia, South Carolina, to Lake Tahoe, San Francisco, have committed to 100% clean energy at the city resolution level. But we're trying to get that to happen at the mayoral level across the country. Eric Garcetti, just south of here, who's the mayor of LA, is also leading something called Climate Mayors. So it's a broader endeavor, and we're sort of dovetailing in it with a stronger demand of 100% clean energy. But their demand is that mayors across the country need to honor the Paris commitment. So after Trump pulled out of Paris, 312 mayors from the U.S., just like in a short period up to the Conference of Mayors meeting, said they're going to stand up and they're going to meet the Paris goal. And I do want to say something about San Francisco, because we're lucky to live in a city that does, at the city level, pay a lot of attention to environmental justice. I'm on the San Francisco Commission on the Environment, led by this amazing, not the commission, but the department's led by this amazing woman named Debbie Raphael. And the commission has environmental justice staff. Mayor Lee's really committed to equity, racial justice, and all our policy making. So it's not that there's not room to get better, but it is it's a good moment to acknowledge that we're lucky to live in a place like this. And for all the shout outs to the need to think of strategic ways to support organizations that are working nationally, support organizations that are working in more conservative places, we have the opportunity to do so. And I think there's groups, I mean, you probably are on a lot of these email lists, like Move On, obviously the Sierra Club, NRDC, there's all sorts of groups working across the country, Van Jones's group, Green for All, that are working in communities across the country to make sure that we can lift up some of the practices we get to enjoy here in the city.
And so Amy, Podera's focused much more locally, right? So going from national to local, are there any big priority pushes for you guys right now that we can help support at the local level?
So locally, we have a lot of projects going on. Podera has a robust programming. We focus on everything from sustainable agriculture. I think backstage, I was talking to one of you about how we're going to be opening this community farm that we got through the Public Utilities Commission here in San Francisco out in the Excelsior. And so it's a really great opportunity for us to teach our community about sustainable agriculture again, you know, being able to produce our own food, making different like chapsticks and tinctures, you know, what are the medicinal properties of plants, right? Just bringing it back to the earth. I think that's really, really important because sometimes we lose touch, but a lot of this, you know, really affects us. We also are doing programs that focus on sustainable and equitable transportation. We have this program called Bicis del Pueblo, or, you know, bicycles of the people. And if you come into our program, you can do an earn a bike. So you volunteer for about 15 hours, but there we, you know, teach you how to fix your bike. You learn how to work cooperatively with everyone else, fixing each other's bikes, and how to ride safely throughout San Francisco. Because we understand, you know, that, you know, transportation, public transportation is the way to reduce our carbon footprint. So that's why bicycles is really, really important, especially in a city like San Francisco. And then we also have a lot of projects around, you know, affordable housing. How do we turn in vacant lots that, you know, Muni is using to store buses, you know, in our disadvantaged communities, bringing all of these buses at the end of the night, polluting our communities? How do we turn these lots into green spaces or even affordable housing for our communities? And we've been working in the Excelsior to do that at the Balboa Upper Yard, as well as our new site that I talked about earlier in 17th and Folsom in the Mission District, right? But again, it's all grassroots led, right? These are the needs of our community, and we make sure that along the process, they're always involved at the beginning, and that we hear from them and we go from there.
Yeah, something you brought up earlier about zoning and land use and how that ties into environmental justice, I think it's important to talk about. As long as we are living in sort of segregated communities, it's easy to target one community or sort of use it as a dumping ground. And really the way to solve for that is to welcome and foster fully inclusive and integrated communities so that we're all living together, and it's you can't so easily pick off one area as a dumping ground for things.
Right, definitely.
So Sharon, I think you wanted to.
And I just want to add that there's so much development happening, especially here in the Bay around the waterfront. It's increasing. It's a place to be right now is on the water. But a place like Bayview Hunters Point, which has been going through a lot of reviews. So Bayview Hunters Point, the shipyard, was basically all land that was owned by the Navy. It's leased out to other industry. They have left. But now there's a lot of new housing development coming in, targeting a variety of different communities to move in. But one of the things that's coming up is proper remediation of some of the toxins that are still there. And so much has been happening around different people that have been hired to supposedly clean up these places, but they are, we're finding information that certain tests are fraudulent, they weren't properly testing. There were 5 whistleblowers that came out recently reporting the problems when they worked for a company called Tetra Tech. So there's a lot of things that are not being clearly communicated. And so there are advocacy groups like Green Action that also hold these companies accountable for having healthy, clean environments for all, not only for the generations of people that have lived in that community, but for new people coming in as well. So I just want to add that there's also, we also need to ask questions about what is the history of the land? Where are we moving to? What are the stories that we're there's so much that's often covered, but we don't really know what's being sold to us also. So that can be another form of discrimination as well, in another way, which I find it's interesting that's coming up too.
Yeah, like you're talking about the development that's happening in San Francisco and in the Bay Area regionally overall. I think it's the California Legislative Analyst Report, I think it was last year, that said basically the only way for California to meet its climate change goals is to focus on infill urban development rather than all the greenfield development that we've been pushing out and the sprawl that we're encouraging by developing what used to be agricultural lands or sort of the farther Bay Area like cities. And so I think as San Franciscans and as people that live in the Bay Area, we have to really think about how we accommodate that growth so as not to push it out into the farmlands, into the greenfields, and cause more sprawl, which just cause more pollution and lessening of the greenfields that we do need to keep. So I think that Green Action do you guys do any of that work regionally?
I mean, we're kind of all over the Bay right now. I've been with the organization for a few weeks now. I was actually hired just to focus really on conversations around water, if you haven't noticed. So anywhere from, you know, meeting with the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and including policy advocacy in their Bay Area plan, working in the Bayview Hunters Point community, we're often invited to communities to advocate and find out what's been happening in their communities, hold different agencies and all different people coming into the community accountable for what's been happening. So we have a task force meeting that happens in Bayview. I will be working with folks in Treasure Island, San Leandro, anywhere water moves, you'll find me. But as an organization with my colleagues, we're always working in a variety of ways with the environment, but really with just communities. And I think that's what's been really interested to me is when you're invited into a community to help and advocate and work with them. That's really, really important. Instead of just coming in and saying, look, we're going to do this for you. I think it's really important to note that as well, because that can be another form of abuse if you're not careful.
Right.
But there's definitely voices that need to be heard, and we need to hold each other accountable.
Great. So Lisa, you mentioned that you are on the commission of the Department of the Environment. I've been working with that department all year on a policy that we just introduced today, so I'm really excited about that. But can you talk more about what kind of work the department does and how the commission, like how your role in the commission plays into that on local issues?
Sure. In some regards, it feels a little bit like that in that we have such a robust department with 100 staff of, I feel like they're a bunch of like A students, like high achieving staff working on all sorts of issues from electric vehicle charging stations to biodiversity in the city. And there's an equity lens on that, like trying to make sure that like our parks and open spaces, particularly in neighborhoods where there's kids who don't have access to parks and wild spaces, or maybe they're not going to Yosemite, you know, those kinds of things. Like how do we make biodiversity flourish here? But at the same time, what how do we do so in a way that doesn't like put people at risk for pesticides? So like if I had to think of like the different purviews, waste is one of it. Like waste and waste treatment, recycling and composting is one area. Energy is more the purview of the Public Utilities Commission. But we still promote clean energy. So there's this great thing, if y'all aren't signed up for it yet, called Clean Power SF, where you can sign up and still pay your PG&E bill, but have your energy be 100% renewable. Or either you can clean power, there's like green, which is a certain percentage renewable, and then deep green is 100% renewable.
And it's not that much more.
I signed up for it. And so there's also transportation and encouraging ride sharing and transit and biking. And so we have these goals called 0, 50, 100 routes, and I'll conclude on that. So the zero is zero waste. Ultimately, our goal is to have 0% of our garbage going to landfill. We wanted to do it by 2020, and we're not going to get there. It's really, really hard. And this is just a little insight of what it's like to be a commissioner. Like if I didn't have a full-time job and two kids and all of that, I could like really delve into thinking, how do we put more pressure on upstream manufacturing? Because how are we supposed to get to zero waste when like even our compostable milk cartons have plastic on them, and every kid drink you've ever opened up at a birthday party is like shrink wrapped? And so it's hard to be really, really good when we're dealing with all these corporate issues.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features We Marched, We Rallied, Now What?, a community panel on environmental rights with Samantha Couch from NextGen Climate, Lisa Hoyos from Climate Parents, Sheridan Inomoto from Green Action, and Amy Aguilera from Poder. They're joined in conversation by Kanishka Karunaratna. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So zero waste, 50% ride sharing, and 100% clean energy, or 50% reduction in vehicular traffic in San Francisco. And then there's things that come into the space, the airspace, if you will, of other agencies. So like Uber and Lyft, I think people thought, oh, those things are going to be great ride sharing. And like you can talk to any taxi drivers like, oh my God, the streets are so congested now. There's like tens of thousands of extra vehicle trips because of those services. But that's the purview of the Public Utilities Commission. But having said that, there's some really great stuff that the commission's doing, like on our electrical charging stuff. We worked with another department, I can't remember which, housing, to make sure that like any new construction has a certain percentage of charging stations in their parking lots. And then also we're trying to make really big strides in public charging, because the state has high EV goals, but if we don't have the public charging accessible, where in San Francisco you need that because so many people don't have garages. So anyway, those kinds of things. Yeah. And to get to your point about where folks in the community can make a difference, one or two people coming to a commission meeting, like people get noticed. So if there, and our agendas are public, you can just go online to San Francisco Commission on the Environment. So if anything interests you on there, or you want to bring something up in public comment, please, please come visit us.
So you mentioned something interesting about this public policymaking process where we are faced with sort of trade-offs and how we make compromises, usually with the lens of environmental justice. So I've been working this year on a flame retardant ban that Supervisor Farrell introduced today with the Department of the Environment that bans the sale of upholstered furniture and children's products treated with flame retardant chemicals, which are very toxic. They're linked to cancer in firefighters, hormone disruption in people, developmental disabilities in children, and issues with your pets as well. And so if we're going to ban the sale of these products, one of the questions was, well, what about secondhand stores and sort of Goodwill? And if you're banning them at secondhand stores, then you're really harming lower-income communities' ability to furnish their homes and access to goods and products, but at the risk of having more toxic products. So, I mean, we spent like a good 6 months debating the pros and cons of this kind of the impact of this policy, and obviously we don't want to inadvertently harm another community. So the trade-off we came up with was trying to fund a program to allow people to swap out the toxic foam in their couches at a lower cost through like a grant that we're trying to get. So these things take time, but it's about being aware of that lens and thinking about it when you're making the policy decisions and knowing that there are going to be people that will hold you accountable to that. So Samantha, Now that the election's over, what is NextGen? Because it seems like you guys are very focused on electoral wins. And so are you already planning for 2018, or what are you doing in this off time right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're certainly looking into 2018. And I think what we found is engagement doesn't stop in an off year. Our list that we've built, the relationships that we've built across these key states need to be nurtured, and they need to be regularly engaged. And so that's kind of what we're focused on this year, is really deepening those relationships, because as I mentioned earlier, we have all these really great tools about, you know, using technology, but at the end of the day, the way that you're going to persuade someone, or the way that you're going to talk someone about the issues, or, you know, kind of get them to understand, is face to face and door to door. And those types of conversations take time. So we're really focused on that. You know, I think that we're expanding on what I talked about of the campus program. And so we're targeting not just campuses this year, but also cities that have a high like millennial percentage of residents. And so really starting that conversation and keeping it going is really a priority for us. And I think, you know, as people are thinking about ways to get involved, a lot of what we do is the hard work for you. So you don't have to figure out what's the number to call my, you know, elected official's office, or, you know, who do I reach out to? We do all of that. And we put these resources up on our webpage. And so I think that, you know, a lot of groups are doing the same thing. And so I think that there are resources out there for you. If you have questions, let me know. But, you know, let us kind of do the legwork, and we'll make it as easily as possible for you.
I think that's an important strategy that I think the Democratic Party has been criticized for, is not maintaining those relationships in some of these other states in the off years, and something the Republican Party did really well prior to the last election. And so I don't know if the party itself is doing that, but I know lots of nonprofits are trying to maintain a presence in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think, too, you know, when campaigns are going into these states and spending a lot of resources and time to abandon that infrastructure.
That's right. And those relationships.
Just, right. It's just a poor investment.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's what we really are trying to do, is build upon what we've started, keep these conversations going, and I think, you know, really energize people going into next year.
Yeah, so if people were engaged in phone banks or going to Nevada, that kind of thing, through the Hillary campaign last year, there are nonprofits that are still sort of doing that kind of work, doing phone banks for specific issues like Save Healthcare. There were a lot of phone banks out of San Francisco to call swing states to have those constituents call their representatives. Because, I mean, our representatives are voting the way we want them to be voting, but we can affect the representatives in other states through our phone banking here. And so if you care about an issue, there's always an advocacy group that can help you plug into reaching the representatives from other states that are maybe swing votes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think over the summer, looking into next month, we're going to be doing a lot of activities around August recess. And so depending on if your elected officials are actually showing up to do town halls to speak with their constituents, there's a lot of activities you can do in California, even to put pressure to have those conversations.
Are you guys focusing on any of the swing districts for 2018? Are there any that we should know about?
Yeah, I mean, I think for specifically in California, we're going to be focusing on several of the Southern California districts.
Orange County, San Diego.
Yeah, all of those. And so, you know, I think that we're looking at potentially doing, if there's, you know, if Ed Royce decides not to do his own town hall, which he likely won't.
Do you know which district that is?
In Fullerton area.
Okay.
And so, you know, we're thinking about maybe we just do a kind of like a people's town hall, or kind of get people together and have them talk about the issues, what's most affecting them, and, you know, we'll send it to his office.
I wanted to add one more thing, because you reminded me, in terms of communication, something, another project that, or communities that I'm working with, are subsistence fishing communities. Those who fish because they really can't afford to buy fish, but they also come from cultures where fishing is just something that is part of the culture that they do when they feed their families. And that exists here in the Bay, just so you know. But one of the things that has come up is multilingual access. something that often gets overlooked. When we're informing a public about, for example, there's hazardous fish here, the signage is in English, but a lot of the communities that fish in the bay, their first language is not English. It could be Chinese, Vietnamese, Spanish. And so in terms, and maybe this is also a question for the panel, and thinking about how we're communicating with public town hall meetings, are we considering multilingual access both in information and an environmental impact report sent to the community? Are we advocating for multilingual access to that and contribution? Those little things we don't often think about but affect a variety of communities.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, so last year we also did a program where we were focused on registering new voters here in California. And in California alone, we registered over 800,000 new voters, the majority of them being young people of color. And I'll mention that some of our strategies that worked so well were something so simple as us doing welcome signs in like 20 different languages, right? Because that sends a message that we are inclusive, that we welcome you, that we want to talk to you, that and it's a really small detail in when you're thinking about these bigger, larger campaigns, but it's something so small that really connects. And I think that it goes a long way. And even with signage or when you're doing these specialized web pages, you know, I know we've considered some stuff around our immigration work in doing it in other languages because at the end of the day, that's really right. who you're talking to. So I thought that was a really good point. Thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just wanted to add that. As a civic engagement organizer in Poder, one of the programs that I work in is our language access network. So San Francisco actually has an ordinance that says that you have to provide individuals who do not speak Spanish with materials and pamphlets in their language at all city departments. The three certified city languages are Chinese, Tagalog, and Spanish. How could I forget? So they have to have bilingual staff on site. Signage has to be in the three languages, and all of the materials also have to be in those three certified city languages. Even if you don't, let's say you speak Arabic or Russian, then they have access to something called Language Line, where you can call in and then they will connect you to a dispatcher who will then do the interpretation into that language. And it's such an important ordinance for our city because, again, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people are not English speakers in the city, and for them to be able to have access to the resources and information that they need, it has to be in their language. And I think as we move forward into environmental justice policy, we really need to recognize that and put that in community-led processes, right? If there is a board hearing or if there is a commission hearing, it needs to be in the language of our communities, because when we don't provide them with the language assistance, then that's another barrier and they're unable to participate. So as we move forward, it's like we have to start writing that into the language of all environmental justice and all types of policies for the state.
Yeah, in San Francisco, at our any of our public meetings, we also have interpretation available in at least the three languages, and we can call more if we get advance notice. Anyway, is there anything else that that you all wanted to mention to our audience tonight?
Yeah, I think I started kind of morphing into the commissioner role, but I did want to say the reason. So this environmental journalist Mark Hertzgard and I started Climate Parents in 2012, and then as an organizer thinking about running a small nonprofit, the idea of joining forces with a big organization like the Sierra Club made a lot of sense because economies of scale, really. Like, the Sierra Club has 64 chapters. We have 13 chapters in California. It's the oldest grassroots environmental organization in the country, but I'm just flagging that because it's a... As we become more digitized, like, how many people remember getting written newsletters from some organization you were a part of back in the day? Yeah, I mean, now everything's online, but I certainly, I remember, you know, in earlier days doing like bulk mailing to, you know, of our newsletters and such of different organizations I was a part of. And so there's nothing that really is more important than the face-to-face, as has been flagged by mis hermanas here on this panel, but it's really critically important. So there's a Bay chapter, if anyone's interested, there's an East Bay chapter, and the Sierra Club is doing really amazing work right now. We have a director of justice, equity, and inclusion on how do you take an organization that has a lot of great things going for it. I mean, it's like we've retired 250 coal plants in the last several years, and we're working hard to replace those, to stop gas and replace those with renewables. But how do you engage in community in a way that's transparent, that's open, that brings resources to underserved communities, that does authentic partnerships? So there's a lot of, I don't want to just call it soul searching, because it's like a lot of intentionality right now happening. And it's fun for me. I've only been there a year because I've been with Climate Parents for 4 years, but just with the club, Sierra Club, for a year. It's fun to watch that process. So I'll just end on this, but every staff person and every chapter staff person across the country, which is about 1,000 people, will be undergoing a 3-day long training on justice, equity, inclusion. It's called Growing for Change. And it looks at all sorts of things, from white supremacy to structural economic disenfranchisement to just a lot of deep stuff that's going to make everyone's kind of emotional intelligence. What are they? It's like
emotional,
just organizing,
yeah,
quotient go up. And so I wanted to name that because it's really important that that level of consciousness sort of begin to enter into all organizations that didn't start out that way. And that organizations that are emerging, like CEJA, California, you mentioned California Environmental Justice Alliance, that's got Communities for a Better Environment. It's got APEN, Asian Pacific Environmental Network. It's, you know, just powerful people of color-led organizations that that the pathways for meaningful engagement with organizations leading at that level. And by the way, like Kevin De Leon or Pro Tem in the Senate and CEJA are like this, like because of his background as a guy who grew up in San Diego, you know, son of immigrant, his mom cleaned homes in La Jolla. Like he brings that psyche and that consciousness and that depth of understanding to the Senate. And then he creates political space, and we also demand political space to shift these policies. So it's an exciting space to be in right now, and thank you for being here to listen to it.
So, I mean, in closing, I just wanted to close with something that really inspired me. Yesterday, I went to see An Inconvenient Sequel, which is Al Gore's sequel to Inconvenient Truth, that really changed the conversation, I think, on climate change for many of us. And something that he's been doing since that first movie came out is doing climate leadership training, where people come together and he gives them training on how to present his slideshow. And so, you know, the movie sort of ended with the Paris Accord and what a great victory that was. But then Trump came into office and we're withdrawing from that and how demoralizing that is. But the inspiration is, you know, if our leaders are not willing to lead, we can lead. And so all these climate trainee graduates are going out into their communities and sort of spreading the gospel of climate change. And that's the kind of grassroots movement that I think is really going to help us all make these changes. So I just want to leave us all with the message that we have the power to make some of these changes. And it can start with something as simple as signing up for Clean Power SF and making sure your home is 100% renewable, your business is, your neighbors are, and just starting there can really help spread this movement. So thank you all for your time today, for coming out to support us. Thank you.
BINA is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was We Marched, We Rallied, Now What?, a community panel on environmental rights, with Samantha Couch from NextGen Climate, Lisa Hoyos from Climate Parents, Sheridan Inomoto from Green Action, and Amy Aguilera from Poder. They were joined in conversation by Kanishka Karunaratna. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.